Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I'll be speaking with Stephen Lee Nash, author of the book Create or Die, Essays on the Artistry of Dennis Hopper, published in 2016 by the Amsterdam University Press. In these essays, Nash looks at different aspects of Hopper's career as a filmmaker, an actor, an artist, and an important person in the history of film. Welcome to Stephen Lee Nash. Hi, Steve. It's great to talk to you.
Hey, Joel. It's great to speak to you, too.
So you've got a collection of essays here, although you've wrote them all. I mean, I have interviewed authors where they've been the editor of a collection of essays, but in this particular case, you actually wrote all the essays. So while we're talking the same subject, Dennis Hopper, throughout, rather than just writing a through book on it, you took the idea of coming up with specific aspects of Hopper and writing individual essays about each part, which is, I think, is a very interesting and useful way to look at when you're trying to do a biographical work of some sort. But let's start with some background. The podcast is obviously devoted to authors, so I always like to learn something about what leads people to specific writing projects. What are your educational and writing experiences?
Yeah, thanks, Joel. A little unconventional compared to some of the authors that you may speak to on your podcast. I actually left school when I was 16, which is kind of a perfectly reasonable thing to do in the UK. You can leave at 16, or at least you could, and have a career. So this was in the kind of late 90s. And I left with pretty much not much of an education, actually. We have GCSEs in England, and I left with maybe two. But initially, I got a job when I was 16. So this was like 1996. And I got a job in this independent camera shop in the town that I grew up in, which is Leicester in England. And I was working there full time. And at this point, really, I had no idea what cameras really did, or editing software, what it was for, or anything like that. And I wasn't a salesperson, so I wasn't really trying to sell this stuff. I was actually working in the dispatch department of its camera shop. So I was handling the goods and not really using it. But over time, I kind of drifted onto the shop floor, and I would watch my colleagues kind of using this, demonstrating this equipment to potential customers. And I guess it must have just absorbed somehow, because sort of 2 years after two years of working at this camera shop, I decided that I would go back to college to resit my GCSEs and to try and get myself at least a half decent education. And I decided that I would go and study media and production. Initially, I actually just wanted to become like a music journalist or something like that. You know, I had that kind of ambition. But when I started this course, which was initially just a 1 year basic kind of introductory to like media and communication, and actually I ended up staying for another 2 years because I enjoyed it so much. I got really into the filmmaking aspects of the course. It was a very practical course. This was at Leicester College, and my tutor was a guy called Matthew Pell, who was a really great guy and really kind of opened up filmmaking, but also film theory as well. So through my time there, I kind of really didn't want to be a music journalist anymore. I kind of wanted to be a filmmaker, and I got really into this. Cameras and the editing software, and a lot of it was, I think, through just osmosis of being close to cameras. And initially, when I was 16, and then that course ended, and I guess I was like 21 at the time, and I felt like I'd learned a great deal of really good like film theory and film practice, and I was still working like a full-time job as well, although I'd moved on. I was working at a bookstore now. And I decided that not to go to university at this point, because I had 3 years of kind of study anyway. But I decided what I would do is kind of start my own kind of one-man band production company. And it was called, initially it was called Kill Film, and then it moved into Frame Drop Film. And, you know, just being like a 21-year-old, my interests were going to clubs, going to see bands live. And I just kind of wanted to mix that. So initially I just used like a small amount of money to buy some cheap editing software, cheapish kind of digital camera. And I just went out to like gigs with my camera and just like filmed bands, basically bands that were like in Leicester and bands that would pass through. And yeah, I basically just kind of developed a kind of small reputation around the live music scene in Leicester of being like a guy to approach and maybe he'll film your band for like next to no money, which initially it was. I think like the first 2 years I maybe made £20 or something like that in kind of money. So I wasn't making any money, but I was really enjoying it, just being in that kind of environment of, you know, live venues, hanging out with bands and, you know, kind of hanging out till like 2 in the morning, just enjoying that. And then, I did some really great work, I think, you know, personally, with bands that kind of came through my hometown and bands that also were living there too. And I made like a documentary film about sort of four bands within Leicester, and kind of strung that together with like no money at all. And I was pretty proud of the fact that I made this kind of almost feature length film. It was kind of like 85 minutes, I think, long. And, you know,
feature length, 85 minutes is certainly.
Yeah, 85 minutes. I think I stretched it out with a few kind of little bizarre little montages in the middle and things like that. But
a long credit sequence at the end.
Stretching out the credit sequence quite a bit there. I think I thanked, pretty much everything I could think of, including like the local supermarket down the road that sold me sandwiches whenever I needed to have like a little in the boots or whatever.
Well, unfortunately, you should have had them give you the sandwiches. Then they would have been paying for their advertising. But
yeah, sounds good. Sounds good. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, so that, I felt like I did some pretty good stuff. But, you know, I got to like the age of 26, 27, actually. And, you know, hanging around sweaty, smoky gig venues was just becoming a little bit tiring, you know. And I'd met the girl that I was going to marry, so the idea of kind of settling down a little bit kind of came into play. And hanging out till like 2 in the morning was just not going to be feasible anymore. And, you know, I had a full time job as well, you know, so I was getting pretty worn out. So about that age, I thought, well, you know what, now maybe it's a good time to try something different. And I actually went back to university this time. So I actually studied with the Open University, which I don't know. Do you happen to know the Open University, what that might be?
No, that doesn't sound –
okay.
I probably haven't heard of it.
I don't know what your equivalents would be. You probably have many state by state in the U.S., but it's a by-correspondence university, basically. There's no buildings. It's just
We have online universities all over the place. I've heard of correspondence universities.
Yeah. The Open University was the first, I think. It started in the 1970s. You could watch Open University programs at like 2 in the morning on Channel 4 or something like that. But now, obviously, you can do it all online. You can do it whenever you want. But yeah, we used to have people, you know, wake up at 2 in the morning to watch the Open University programs in the 1980s and stuff like that. So yeah, it's moved on quite a bit, but this was the best way for me to do it. So I actually studied a bunch of different things. First of all, I studied creative writing. And then I studied essay writing, and then I studied some politics. So basically I kind of feel like all my experience from the age of 16 is kind of now all rolled into my writing as an adult, basically. So that's kind of my background. Yeah.
It's funny. When you were describing how you first learned film by learning about the equipment.
Yes.
That is actually pretty standard. I mean, if you've ever heard or read about some of the probably the more well-known filmmakers of the present day were some of the what we would now consider to be the giants, like Spielberg and Lucas and even Coppola. Yeah. They spent a large amount of their early, especially Spielberg and Lucas, they talk about they were just fooling around with 8mm cameras as they were kids, and they started to learn the technology materials first, yeah. and then they started to learn storytelling as they went forward. So it's not that strange of a way to do it. And of course you then, and then they ended up going to schools. So your career path, so to speak, is quite normal, it seems, for modern filmmakers these days. So it's not a complete surprise.
That is very true, actually. Unfortunately, you know, my film career, it's a sideline with my actual career as a bookseller and now as a library assistant. So I earned a living doing other things that I still enjoy, because obviously I'm big on on books, but there was not much opportunity to earn a lot of money. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a really good point, mate. Yeah.
The other good thing is that nowadays you don't have to, that you have it better than them, in the sense that, as you just pointed out, you don't have to spend huge amounts of money on equipment and even editing. You can use the same editing software that, if you have the right equipment, that they use to make feature-length film, you know, that the full studios do. So it is a positive. I think you were coming up at the perfect time as far as both education and the technology part.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, working for the video store, the camera store back in Leicester, it wasn't like my first exposure to video cameras. My dad had like the super VHS cameras that were big in the 1980s and literally big as well. Like they were unmanageable. And so I remember him kind of on our holidays slugging this huge thing around his neck and, you know, just being completely impractical. But by the time I was here, we were just getting into digital cameras, and they were getting pretty palm-sized and small. So, yeah, it was a decent time for sure.
So, obviously this book is about Dennis Hopper. Have you written anything else prior to this about any place else, or is this your first published work?
I have a collection of essays published in 2014 called USA. Which was published by Zero Books, which are they're a kind of small independent radical press, and I went with them for this for that first book, and that's been out for a couple of years, and then throughout sort of from sort of 2013 onwards, I've been writing kind of film politics, cultural essays, articles, and you know, just since then, like clocking up quite a few by now, I think. So this is my second book. Yeah.
That's good. Now, before we get in depth, did you write these essays sort of one at a, you know, at the same time, that is one right after the other, or some of these things that you started on and have been sitting around and you finally said, well, I think the best way to publish these or to get these published is to just bring them together?
I think it kind of happened by accident in some ways. In 2012, my wife and I and our young son, who was just, he was 18 months at this point. We were living in the UK and we decided to move to Canada. My wife's Canadian. It made moving pretty quick, pretty easy. But, the situation in the UK at that time wasn't so great. You know, she'd lost her job. I was losing mine. We had the big recession. There was lots of cuts. So it was making life difficult anyway in the UK. And so we moved to Canada in 2012. And for about 4 or 5 months, I just couldn't work. Like I wasn't allowed to work in Canada until I actually got like my visa through, just like a work visa. Mm-hmm. So at that point, like I was basically free to do some like writing, and all these ideas that I'd had about writing kind of film related to politics, related to culture, just sort of like was finally I had a bit of time to just sort of sit down and do it. So I started in 2012, and you know, within like a year, well, within the space of a year, I had this collection of essays, and I thought, this is great, you know. And I think one day I just decided, oh, what would it be like if I just put all these essays in one Word document together, and how would that look? And, you know, I was just surprised that there was kind of like almost like a running narrative throughout these essays. And I submitted it to a publisher, and they worked to Zero Books, and they kind of went with it. And I was just like, oh, this was fantastic. It was, I think it was a little bit of a stroke of luck, but, you know, I was really happy because Zero, being a bookseller in the UK as well, I'd come across Zero Books a few times, and, you know, I was always really interested in their work. So, yeah, so that's kind of how, yeah, that's how the first one came about, really. It was just by mistake. And at the time, I was already writing this Dennis Hopper book. So, yeah, it kind of worked out well.
So what, I mean, you talk about it a little bit in the introduction to the book of what suddenly made you think of, you know, what led Dennis Hopper to you, so to speak. But could you talk a little bit about, I think you talk about it, as I say, Blue Velvet seemed to be the film that really struck you. And
yes,
particularly as it relates to Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
What was the background of that, and how did that lead you to deciding, well, I need to find as much as possible about this particular artist?
So I think like Dennis Hopper had kind of cropped up through my kind of early film viewing. You know, he'd been in Speed, which was a pretty big film for me, but he was just the generic bad guy in that movie. He'd been in like Waterworld, which again, just the generic bad guy. There just didn't seem much, you know, at the time during that kind of 90s period when he was appearing in a lot of those big budget movies, he didn't seem to have a lot of depth. But you know, when I got to college and started learning a little bit more about film, I really started immersing myself more in older films, to be honest, you know, films from the 60s, from the 70s. And I remember I went to Virgin Megastore, which no longer exists. And they were selling off their videos for like, I think it was like £2 each or three for £5. So I was in there and I was just like, you know, okay, you know, what films have been mentioned recently in our film classes? And Mean Streets and Taxi Driver were two. So I found them and I picked those up and I was like, okay, I need one more. I need one more film to make up the £5 deal. And I just happened to see Easy Rider there, and I'd heard about it a little bit, and it looked cool. You know, the cover looked great. The two rambling, you know, motorcycles across the highway and stuff. And so I purchased it. I took it home, and during that weekend, I kind of watched all three movies, and I think Easy Rider initially just struck a chord with me a little bit more than Mean Streets or Taxi Driver, actually, just because at the time, you know, I was listening to a lot of kind of 60s and 70s music. So I was listening to Dylan, you know, The Byrds, Hendrix, The Doors. And I was reading Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson and On the Road. So like I almost had this kind of like the film almost was like a visual representation of all the things that I was kind of interested in, like this kind of road journey with this awesome soundtrack as well. So Easy Rider just kind of struck me. And then, you know, it came up directed by Dennis Hopper and starring Dennis Hopper. But even then, like I was pretty amazed that kind of this guy, the guy from Speed, directed this movie back in the 60s. And I was, you know, pretty amazed by that. But to be fair, like it was still his co-star Peter Fonda was still like the coolest thing in that movie. And for a while, if I hadn't seen Blue Velvet, maybe I would have wrote the book Create or Die: Essays on the Artistry of Peter Fonda. I don't know, because for a little while there, I was really into Peter Fonda. But yeah, I don't know. Like I happened to just be watching a few years later. I happened to just be watching TV. It was like Channel 4, which is the UK channel, which has like a bit more kind of edgy films and TV programs. And Blue Velvet came on. I'd seen like a few David Lynch movies like Lost Highway and Doom, but Blue Velvet had kind of passed me by. But again, it was a movie that I kind of heard about from film magazines, from film class and things like that. So I thought, okay, you know what, I'll watch this. It was late at night. I drank like half a bottle of wine anyway. I thought, yeah, I can stay up and watch this. This will be a thing. I was watching it thinking this is kind of a nice, woozy kind of film. It's a kind of noir, kind of gentle, but then Frank Booth, Dennis Hopper makes his entrance into the film and things kind of get pretty nasty from there. And I think I had that first kind of out of body experience almost watching that film, because I was probably, my whole like body posture changed. I think I was lying on the couch with a glass of wine in my hand, and then he came on, Dennis Hopper came on as Frank Booth, and by the end of the scene ended, which is the scene initially where he kind of barges into Isabella Rossellini's apartment and kind of brutally abuses her. I think by the end of that scene, I was like, the glass of wine was on the floor. I was like sitting straight up, and I hadn't even noticed that I'd moved. It was like one of those really strange things where time just stood still, and I kind of came out of it and I was a completely different position. So I continued watching the film, and it just kind of made this huge like splash. And I think I went back and I watched Easy Rider again. I've been a big fan of Apocalypse Now, but again, Dennis Hopper in that was kind of crazy, where he kind of plays this crazy photojournalist right at the end of the film. And I kind of went back and I just thought, man, this guy's actually a genius. Like, I've got to go and find more Dennis Hopper movies. So that was kind of where that began, for sure.
When I was reading through the first essay, which is basically a review of his career.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Reading through that, and I think if anybody reads the book and reads that chapter, they're going to say, he was in that? Oh, that's right, he was in that. And you, like you say, Apocalypse Now, I remember that he's in there, and I, as soon as I read Dennis Hopper, I did the same thing. I said, you're right, he was in that. Because, yeah. for one thing, that movie's got so much going for it as it is that remember who.
No, it's was got a bunch of so many cameos. Yeah.
Remembering that Hopper was in it at the end, it was, oh, yeah, you're right. And then some of his other works, you just don't remember. Oh, that's right, he was in that. Because he wasn't one of those actors who had to be the focal point. He was perfectly willing to do. He would do a movie like Blue Velvet, but then he was perfectly happy to do a smaller role in other kinds of films, just because he felt, if he felt that was a good role for him, and if particularly if directors wanted him, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with it as well. He obviously, by the time of Apocalypse Now and even later, he had a good reputation for what he could do, and I think that's one of the reasons why he sometimes pops up and you say, oh, that's right, he was in that movie.
Yeah, definitely. There's a whole bunch of actors similar to that. But yeah, he just kind of jumps out a little bit more. I remember watching Apocalypse Now when I was maybe like 16 or 17 and having no idea that who Colonel Kurtz was, who Marlon Brando was, who Dennis Hopper was. I just kind of remember watching that movie. And then when he turns up, I thought, is that Colonel Kurtz? Because if that's Colonel Kurtz, this is really the most messed up movie, but then, it's revealed, and then, Marlon Brando is Colonel Kurtz. But I remember just feeling like, man, I'm disappointed that that guy is not Colonel Kurtz.
Well, that's unfortunate. The one thing that most people, especially when it first came out, and I don't know if it's changed, I haven't gone back lately and read anything up to, more current about Apocalypse Now. Most people said that until, the movie was absolutely spectacular until they finally got to where Kurtz was, and that's when things got crazy. And
yeah.
So maybe it made sense that Dennis Hopper showed up at that moment.
I think so, yeah. It does make sense for sure, yeah.
So, as I say, your book is it's a series of essays with an introduction to the whole set, plus then your first essay is a review of his career. And then you devote other chapters on other essays either to general topics or to specific films.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about, the overview as I've already mentioned, was a very good way of learning, for especially for people who may have heard of Dennis Hopper, or like you say, may have seen a film or two that he was in, and then you suddenly get an overview of what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about in that first chapter then a number of his films, and also more importantly the arc of his career, because obviously for a variety of reasons he definitely had a reputation, and even though he had successes, he also had a number of failures, and probably the most jarring example of that was The Last Movie, which you had a lot of good things to say about it, but obviously at the time it did not go over very well. Let's talk a little bit about The Last Movie as an example of maybe Hopper as misunderstood.
Yeah, quite possibly. You know, he had a huge success, him and Peter Fonda, and Terry Southern as well, who doesn't get an awful lot of credit. He's kind of been written out of the picture, but, you know, Terry Southern was a screenwriter, and he helped write the screenplay, and I think he deserves some credit for sure. But, you know, Hopper and Fonda pretty much wrote their own ticket in kind of New Hollywood, and after Easy Rider, they were given, you know, a bunch of money, which at the time was a lot, but it was just $1 million each to go and make some films separately. And Peter Fonda went and made this kind of film, this kind of Western, existential Western called The Hired Hand. And Hopper went and made a film called The Last Movie. And The Last Movie was written with a guy called Stuart Stern, who was the screenwriter on Rebel Without a Cause. And it was at some point, it was a straightforward movie with a linear narrative and a straightforward story about a film crew that go to Peru and set up their film apparatus and film sets, and they make a film, and then they leave, and they leave all their kind of like their sets behind, and I guess it was like the effects of Hollywood or the effects of modernity on a kind of indigenous culture. But yeah, somewhere along the line, editing, and this you can kind of go and watch a film called The American Dreamer, which is a film that was made during the post-production of The Last Movie, and kind of see where it all went wrong. The film is great. Like, actually, I think it's a real, like, monumental piece of from that time. But, you know, I can understand the audience's kind of loving Easy Rider, and the films coming out at that time would just been, like, so confused by this, the movie that eventually became The Last Movie, because it's a disjointed narrative, completely nonlinear. But then there's also these, you know, bizarre performances, from Hopper, from the other members of the cast. It's a pretty jarring kind of soundtrack as well. But yeah, if you look at the American Dreamer, the documentary that was made during the post-production of that film, you can see where Hopper was so distracted. You know, he's lost it on drugs and drink. He's got his like bunch of hangers on that are just like, you know, hanging on to him and kind of distracting him. He's got his groupies. It's a pretty like, it's a pretty dark film to kind of watch. But you can see where The Last Movie went wrong. But I think within time, it was ahead of its time, in some respects. So, I think that it's today, and I think it's going to be viewed today as a really good movie in some respects, but, it's an art movie. It's an artistic movie. Right.
Unfortunately, there are a number of examples of people who made a splash with an initial film or an initial performance who were then signed up to say, here, have some money and keep going.
Yeah.
And while some of them were very successful with their next, then there's also the examples of where it didn't go the way that I think the people who were financing them expected them to go.
And I think it was the finances of that movie that really did pull it. Because, you know, I mean, it did win an award at Venice. You know, Hopper was always saying that about The Last Movie, that it won the Venice Film Festival Award. I think for Best Director. I'm not 100% sure. I'll have to go back and check. But you know, so it was well-received critically, at least artistically critically well-received. But I think by the general film critics of that time, they were just confused by it. But yeah, you're right. There has been tons of examples, but I don't think it didn't need to be that way in some respects, but it did turn out that way. And I think, you know, Hopper is to blame for that a little bit as well, you know, because he was pretty wild in that decade. You know, the 70s were a pretty wild decade for him. So, yeah.
So speaking of, you know, while we're still talking about overview, in writing that first chapter where you talk about his career, besides the last movie where you spend a little bit more time on that, what other performances or even, you know, writing and director activities do you feel like he doesn't get good credit, doesn't get the proper due that you think he deserves in his overall work? Things that people may have forgotten or may have never even thought, oh yeah, that's right, that was Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, I think a really interesting period of Dennis Hopper's career is the 1970s, pretty much from the last movie, which was 71, up until his next directorial film, which was a film called Out of the Blue, which was 79. We can talk about that in a minute if you like, but that period of, like, you know, 9 or 10 years in between, where he was not working in Hollywood really at all, but he was working abroad in Europe and in Australia and in Canada as well, and in, you know, very small independent movies in the US. I think that's a really potent time for him because, it was a case of quality over quantity. He only made probably about 7 or 8 films in that period, and that's like films like Trax, which was from 76, which was Henry Jaglom, where he plays this kind of this very disturbed Vietnam vet who's traveling across the country. And it's a very, very small, it's got Dean Stockwell in as well. It's a very small film, but it's beautifully acted, beautifully shot. And also, The American Friend as well, that he made, in Germany at the time, with, Wim Wenders. Again, it's a beautiful performance, and that film's actually an adaptation of Ripley's Game, and he plays the character Tom Ripley. But if you've watched any of the Ripley movies from, you know, the kind of 1990s, it's a very different interpretation of that character. And then, you know, you've got Apocalypse Now. And I think the kind of the maddest film in his 1970s kind of canon is Mad Dog Morgan, which is a film he made in Australia, where he plays, he actually portrays a real life bushranger, this guy called Daniel Morgan, who was around in the 1800s, kind of Irish. He was like a bushranger, an outlaw. And he's crazy in that movie. But again, it's a great film in terms of the way that it's shot. And Helper's performance is kind of tragic, funny. I don't know. I feel like the 70s is a period of time that he's not going to get much credit for because there wasn't a lot of movies made, and a lot of them were under the radar. I mean, I think the biggest movie from that period is Apocalypse Now. So that whole decade, I think, it really deserves more credit than it does. And, you know, when I'm saying, like, quantity over quality, if you look at, like, his later work where he's, like, making movies from, like, the late 90s to the late 2000s, you know, he did a lot of movies, and there are a lot of straight to DVD stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can pick a few gems out of there, but ultimately you can go back to the 70s, and every film is worthy of watching just to see how kind of crazy, how kind of mad his performances can be. You know, so yeah, the 70s I think deserves a real good. I think people should really watch those movies from that period.
I think part of the other issue, especially during that period, is if he was making a lot of films overseas, those were virtually impossible to see back then. I mean, one of the things I think people who maybe are younger don't know or don't think about it is that if you grew up at the right time, being able to see some of these films were probably almost impossible. because if they didn't show them up in a theater, you weren't going to see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it was really down to the art house cinemas to show those movies, which were virtually impossible to get hold of. I think The American Friend was a well-received movie, but I don't really know how well it was received in the States. And Mad Dog Morgan wouldn't have even been on the radar of any place in the US at the time, so that would have gone completely unseen. Probably pretty big in Australia, though, because Daniel Morgan is kind of a legend, kind of like, So, yeah.
But at least nowadays, a lot of these films can be seen, and that does help when you're writing a book like yours, which, you know, is devoted to one person.
Yeah.
Not being, you know, if I, for example, when I was younger, I remember reading a book about Frank Capra, and I loved the book, and it was a great book and everything, but I said to myself, I've never seen any of these films. Because, you know, in pre-video, you couldn't unless they happened to show up on TV. And, of course, that was before cable in a lot of ways for me, because I'm a little bit older than you. And so it was almost impossible to see some of these films. And yet you read about it and you want to see them. I mean, simple things like those kind of issues, seeing Citizen Kane for the first time. Nowadays, it's a piece of cake to see these films. And the best you could hope for was a film class. And I did remember taking a film class in my undergraduate program where I actually saw films that I finally got a chance to see films. And it was on, you know, a 16-millimeter projector because that was the only way they could show them.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, if anyone's interested, I found the last movie on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube. It's all there. Probably shouldn't say that. They'll probably get taken down now. But, yeah, it's there, and it can be seen there for sure in pretty good quality too. So
that's good.
You can do a whole search like that.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the other chapters specifically before, you know, instead of specific films now. Let's talk a little bit about some of your generalized topics, particularly the first one after the introduction, you know, after the overview, and that's Dennis Hopper and music. And you definitely presented it right at the beginning with Easy Rider. Easy Rider definitely is an example of an early film that made the most of a rock soundtrack, where nowadays those kind of, not the same way anymore, obviously, but it's just a given that, you know, a movie's going to have different performers doing different songs. Now, of course, and so, but clearly Hopper was one of the first to consider the importance of using rock as a soundtrack. And so he clearly picked the right, like you even gave a little bit of a background earlier, some of the music that was used in that film and the artists, and it definitely presented a new way of looking at the music. So what was Hopper's thinking as far as trying to bring in music from, you know, popular music as opposed to old style soundtracks?
So, I mean, you know, my thoughts on this really are that he was placing cultural signposts within his directorial films. So when you look at Easy Rider, you know that you're watching a film from the 1960s because of the soundtrack. You know, you can instantly recognize those 60s songs. And I think he did the same thing with another film that he made after the last movie, but maybe 7 or 8 years later, called Out of the Blue, where he actually, you know, Out of the Blue is an interesting film because he just got a role in that movie. It was a Canadian production, and he was cast as the father in this kind of melodramatic TV movie. And then the director of that film walked off set 2 weeks into production, and Hopper took it over and kind of rewrote the script, recast a few things, and was given the opportunity, as long as he could bring it in on time and under budget. And so he got that role. And I think, you know, at that time there was the punk scene was kicking off in the US and the UK. And he put this punk rock element into that film, at a time when that was really the music that people were listening to, or at least a certain amount of people were listening to that. He kind of made that film a very kind of real punk rock film, And I think it's quite influential in that way. And then when you look at Colors, which was a film he made in 86, which was about the gangs in Los Angeles, again, he put this hip-hop soundtrack in it because it represented the characters, basically. And I think that's another thing, too. You know, it's the same thing with Out of the Blue. The punk music in Out of the Blue represents the kind of the punkishness of the characters and the kind of 60s music, the hippie soundtracks and things like that are really kind of soundtracking, you know, the characters of that film, too. So I think I think that's kind of what he was doing, you know, is just making his work really current and really recognizable as being from a certain era.
And that's where I think most people who think about Easy Rider, of course, there probably aren't a lot of people who think about it regularly these days, but no question during the time period, it was the soundtrack that many people will remember because they just weren't used to that kind of a soundtrack when that film came out. You know, that was unusual. And now, I said before, nowadays it's just normal. But back then it wasn't normal. It was very unusual.
No, I think that's the same thing with Colors, too. I mean, that was a really representative film of kind of the black youth of America. And, you know, I think it was Chuck D that said, you know, hip-hop is the TV of America. It's just, you know, it was representing the lives of black youth at that time. So to really kind of add that soundtrack was unheard of, really. You know, there was no hip-hop in mainstream, not really hitting the mainstream. And I think that the soundtrack record was actually, you know, one of the biggest selling albums of that year. And it kind of brought hip-hop to more national attention, I think. So, yeah,
there were a couple of filmmakers, but, you know, I'm thinking also of, you know, Do the Right Thing and some other similar films. But you're right, he would have been in that same period. So it's definitely no question that.
It really did hit more of the mainstream in the late 80s. But I think Hopper's film, you know, really did a lot for putting hip hop in the mainstream there.
One of the other chapters talks about the movie White Star. And I wanted to talk about this since it's probably one of the only chapters where you devoted it just to basically one film. Some of the other chapters talk about multiple films. And the chapter, White Light, White Heat, Actor and Character Collide in White Star. What was it about White Star that led you to decide, well, this is a film I think deserves a chapter all by itself?
So if you don't mind, I'll just actually just do a little history of where this book began, because when I started this project, which was like back in 2010, actually, I started writing this book. I really wanted to write a very kind of pop culture book on sort of 10 underappreciated Dennis Hopper movies. That was the mission statement of this book initially. And I was searching Amazon for copies of films which I'd never really heard of. And I remember I brought like a bunch. And White Star was amongst them. And it was actually one of the most expensive films to actually get off Amazon. Usually they were just like a couple of pence to get the film. And the postage cost more for Amazon to send it to me. But White Star was on there, and I think it was like nearly 20 pounds or something like that. That's quite a lot of money from Amazon. And anyway, I got that film, and I watched, you know, a bunch of these sort of straight to DVD movies. And I was really inspired by this book that was published at the time called Seagology, which was about the films of Steven Seagal. that was quite a genius book in a way, because it took Steven Seagal's pretty like awful movies and kind of made a case for them of actually being like amazing. It wasn't that convincing, but the book itself kind of inspired me to sort of write this book on Dennis Hopper, where it was kind of taking a kind of jokey look at some of his films. But you know, as I was writing this book, it became like unfeasible for me to kind of justify some of the films that I was writing about, such as like a pretty awful movies from the 90s called like Space Truckers and Tychus. And I just thought, man, when I kind of got like this manuscript a year or so later, I was kind of reading it thinking, oh man, like this is not the kind of book that I think I want to write anymore, because, you know, I was researching Hopper's life and thinking there's so much more to this guy than these crappy straight to DVD movies. But amongst those movies was a few that I thought really did stand out. And within the book, there is still kind of a couple of leftover chapters from that original kind of mission statement of the book. And one of them is a chapter on the blackout and acts of love, and the other one is White Star. And White Star White Star is a film from it's a German film from 1984, kind of one of the last films that Dennis Hopper made while being kind of exiled from Hollywood. He'd come back a couple of years later in 1986 with Blue Velvet and Hoosiers and River's Edge. But White Star, I think, represents a really dark time in Hopper's career. And you can really tell that in the performance, because it is a pretty intense performance, in that it isn't a performance at all. He's not really acting in that movie. He is just being himself in that movie. And it's a pretty wild, it's a wild take, because you can tell that he's kind of he's on drugs. He's definitely drinking. I think he said in an interview a couple of years before he died that, you know, the worst movie that he made was White Star, and it took him a lot of drugs to get through that. But you know what? I disagree with him. I think it's actually a really great film. Again, it's kind of similar to Out of the Blue, in that it kind of has like a kind of punk rock element to it. He plays a music manager in the film to this kind of budding David Bowie type of musician. And he basically ruins this guy's career because he's trying to get as much kind of publicity for his forthcoming album. So he does incredibly like crazy stuff. Like, he puts him on stage in front of like a bunch of Berlin punks, and he plays this kind of synth music, and it's kind of wild. I just think that it's a real kind of standout film for Hopper, but it's a very dark movie to watch, because you are basically watching someone who's really, you know, at the bottom of his soul. You know, he's really he's really desperate in that movie, I think, to get off drugs and get off drink. And, you know, the next year he would, you know, he went into rehab in 1985 and got clean and stayed clean for the rest of his life, you know. So you can just kind of see that that's a real turning point. So really the reason that I wanted to focus on that film was because a lot has been written in previous books about Hopper's kind of wild lifestyle and the drugs and the drink. But that it always kind of ignores the films that were made during that period. And I think White Star is kind of representative of that kind of debauched period of his life. But there is actually still, you could sort of see that even though he was in that state, he was still producing like incredibly raw performances. So I think it's just a worthwhile film to go check out. And to write about too. It was a joy to write about.
So in doing the research for this book, so to speak, which means watching all the films that you watched over time, and I lost track a little bit. When did you see the first Dennis Hopper film? I don't remember if you said specifically. I'm just trying to get a time period as to how long between when you first became aware of Dennis Hopper and the ending of the book. I don't know what time period that is.
Well, I don't know. If you take in things like Speed, then
the first one, right? You mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, probably. You know, I mean, I was, you know, when I was a young teenager, Speed was a huge film for me, because right. It was a proper great action movie, and you know, Keanu Reeves was cool in that movie. I'm a big fan of Point Break as well. That's another kind of guilty pleasure of mine. But
and of course, that film also was probably one of the breakout roles for Sandra Bullock too. So
yeah,
it was
exactly.
A very interesting film for what it did for careers.
Exactly. No, it is a very interesting movie. But at the time, it was pure,
right.
You know, adrenaline rush of a film. But I kind of respect it a lot more now as naturally a kind of genre defining film.
Of course, my problem with it was, And I know it's a silly thing, but I get this way with films sometimes. I said to myself, supposedly he blows himself up at the beginning of the film, and yet they all assume he's dead. And I said, well, didn't they look for body parts?
I know, really.
There's no way in the world he could have blown himself so much up that there wouldn't be some remnants of something.
Yeah. Some teeth.
Yet they all seem to think, yeah, he's dead.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know.
That's but that's not Dennis Hopper's fault. He didn't write the film, so.
No, he didn't.
But I guess my original question where I was heading for is what kind of surprises have you found over the years in viewing Dennis Hopper, both as a filmmaker and as an actor? I mean, what kind of things came along during your study of him that surprised you about him?
I think, you know, initially when I set out to write this book, you know, as I kind of explained in the last question, I was just sort of thinking that this guy is a film presence that deserves to be kind of written about. And I didn't want to sort of write it that seriously, but, you know, I wanted to take his film work seriously enough to kind of reevaluate some of his not older films, but his like unseen films. But I think, you know, initially when I had that, when I had that version of the manuscript, I was more surprised that I was more interested in just the other elements of his career. Like, I kind of knew that Dennis Hopper was a bit of an artist and maybe was a bit of a photographer as well, but I didn't really delve into that until I actually started getting into the real research of the book. And, you know, I was pretty blown away. Like, I can give and take a little bit of, you know, art. It's not totally my thing, but I was just blown away by the fact that, like, alongside making movies, he was also taking photographs, making sculptures, painting. You know, that's a huge surprise when you think, man, the guy from Speed, from Space Truckers, is this incredible photographer, is this incredible artist. And also an art collector as well. Like, he was actually an art connoisseur. Like, he brought some of the early Warhol stuff, the Marcel Duchamp. You know, he's kind of like lived his life artistically in the shadows of some of his film work. And I think that was kind of a big surprise too. That was a big surprise. But then also, as I was looking into things like, you know, I don't know if we're going to talk about this chapter, but I'll just quickly mention it now. You know, the chapter that I talk about where his advertisements and commercials that he did, you know, that's, I mean, I think I kind of remember the Ford Cougar advert, which was on in the early 90s, you know, but I was surprised that, oh, it's Dennis Hopper, yeah, in that. And then, you know, you see him throughout his kind of career, you know, in these kind of commercials, and I was just like, okay, so the guy who made the last movie, Out of the Blue, Colors, Easy Rider, also appeared in an advert for the Ford Cougar. Okay, that's really interesting because that's kind of like, you know, the blurring of high culture and low culture. And he seemed to surf that pretty easily, like go back and forth between the two. I think that's just incredible.
Well, there are a number of actors who do television commercials. They just choose not to do American television commercials to sort of hide that they're doing television commercials.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, Nicolas Cage, I think, is a great example of that. He's been in some crazy Japanese television adverts, and yeah, you wouldn't really know unless you know, if YouTube didn't exist, we'd never know this.
Because that's the film that Bill Murray did with Scarlett Johansson, and unfortunately, it's completely,
yeah.
I mean, that was the whole premise of why he was in Japan, because he was there to do
$2 million. Yeah,
he's getting paid a lot of money to do some television commercials, yeah, that would never be seen and he's well known in the United States, but
yeah,
you of course can't do television commercials in the United States. And
yeah,
I think you're right. That's where Hopper decided that he wanted to do something because he wanted to do it. I mean, I
yeah,
still remember when he showed up in 24, the first season of 24, at the end, towards the end, he suddenly showed up as becoming the overall bad guy of the first season. And it was total shock, because that was before, obviously, the kind of information gets out, you know, casting, it's pretty obvious anymore who's going to be where, but it was a big surprise when he showed up, and he made a definite splash for those few episodes he was on. That, oh my goodness, that's Dennis Hopper. He's
yeah,
on television.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he did do a bunch of TV in the later part of his career, because he also did Crash as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a bit of a, kind of a surprise, but yeah, that's great. Yeah.
So overall, then you obviously devoted a lot of time, not only writing, but obviously the background. And people who don't write don't understand that the writing part is often the quickest part of the whole project. It's getting, you know, fiction's one thing, but nonfiction, you the amount of research you have to do and the amount of information. What kind of source, were you able to mostly do this based on viewing films, or did you have to do some extra research? I mean, you indicate you work in a library, so it's not a surprise that you might be able to do some research, but what kind of other research did you have to do for this book?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, like initially, the research was just watching movies, but as I kind of tried to fill in some of the gaps, you know, I looked back at some Hopper biographies that were published in the 1980s. And then when he died in 2011, actually, sorry, no, I don't think he died in 2011. He died in 2009. Yeah, 2009. There was a bit of a change in perspective of what Hopper did. Who Hopper was, and you know, he was still regarded as an actor, but all of a sudden there was a lot of talk about his artistic work, so his artwork and his photography. And you know, at that time there was all of a sudden you know, a bunch of monographs that were published featuring a lot of his photography work. There's this, you know, there's a couple of actually really beautiful books that are published by Taschen, which are, you know, just incredible documents of the 1960s. And then there was also exhibitions of his work, initially in France and then in Australia and then in the US. And so, yeah, like all of a sudden there was a lot more kind of work out there based on, you know, on his artwork and on his life. It kind of... that kind of shied away from his life as a kind of, you know, his more debauched aspects of his life, the drink and the drugs and things like that. So that was pretty refreshing to get away from that and to kind of read up some stuff on that. So, yeah, you know, I initially, I got hold of those books and would kind of immerse myself in those. And then, you know, the internet is great because pretty much any interview he ever did is on YouTube. Or in print online. So that was pretty good. I could always sort of dip into any of his interviews. When it came to writing things about like the music chapter, again, I kind of went back to how it was at the beginning of the book and, you know, kind of immersed myself in some of the music that was coming out at that time. And the music that was in his films and some of the music videos that he appeared in. And he even actually appeared on some people's songs as well. So, yeah, that was kind of a fun chapter to kind of get into.
So, obviously, you've devoted a lot of time to Dennis Hopper, and you've developed a pretty good, a very good overview and specifics in this particular book. What other writing do you have? Other writing projects going on, or are you going to continue to write about film, or are you writing about different things now?
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, I will kind of expand away from film a little bit, but I've still got, you know, film projects, writing projects on the go at the moment. So as it stands at the minute, film is just kind of where it's at. I think that the beauty of film is that you can use it as a portal to look at other aspects of you know, our society, our culture. And I think that's the interesting thing. Film is just an easy way in to look at different things. So actually, you know, I've got, I have another book coming out next year, again with Zero Books, that's all about Dirty Dancing. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, It's slightly different from writing about Dennis Hopper, but definitely. But I
slightly
agree with
different,
you.
yeah. Well, you know that particular film, Dirty Dancing, has kind of haunted me throughout my entire life. You know, it's one of those films that I was introduced to, where you know, at a very young age, probably by my sister, and then you know, subsequently, you know, girlfriends. You have to do that as a male, right? You've got to sit down and watch those kind of films with your girlfriend or your wife. But Dirty Dancing has, you know, over the years has just kind of opened up to me a little bit more. There's a lot going on in that film. So maybe one, you know, when it's out next year, maybe I can teach you about that as well.
And that'd be great because, as I say, I think you're absolutely right. And it's one of the things in virtually every person I've talked to in my interviews, when we talk about either a filmmaker or a film probably more than any other, I think more than any other genre of art, most mirrors society. Because it becomes the way, I mean, I'm not saying music doesn't have its points and live theater does as well, but there's just something about film or, you know, in these days video where it's, you can watch a film and often figure out its time period just from watching the film. If you don't give it any hint, without any hints or any background other than just show the film, even you often can pretty much figure out when it was filmed, you know, what time period it came out, even if it's supposed to be a period piece.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, totally agree.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you about this book, and I definitely think people need to not only reach out and read the book, but just as importantly, take some time to revisit Dennis Hopper and don't just remember him for the most obvious performances.
Mm-hmm.
But go back and try to find some of the more unusual choices he made and some of those films that you believe in particular he deserves to be remembered for just as much as the other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's really being revisited, I think, as a photographer and artist, in the last sort of 5 years, you know, since his death. And, you know, he's had countless, you know, exhibitions of his work and, five or six monographs published in the last, 5 years too of his artwork. But, you know, there is a great deal of artistic work within his films as well, which I think, you know, it shouldn't be forgotten. And that should definitely be revisited for sure. So, yeah.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you. And like I said before, hopefully when your next book comes out, you'll keep me in mind and we'll do another interview. We'll talk about Dirty Dancing.
Absolutely. That sounds great, Joel.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Take care now. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Steve and that you reach out to better understand why Hopper was such a great film artist. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.